the former stable yard, and you could say this is where the whole story really begins. The government code and cipher school were in the minority against the other departments posted here and squeezed for office space. Fortunately, Captain Faulkner, the original developer, as part of his concept for the site, had managed to convert the former Apple Pear and Plum store into accommodation, the building we call the bungalow. Equally, he'd converted the former feed and tack rooms, identified as cottages 2 and 3. So it was within this precinct that Dilwyn Knox, the senior cryptanalyst, was charged by Commander Denniston with setting up a team to attack Enigma. Now, our authorities knew all about Enigma, but because of their pre-war priorities, had actually made no study of it. So on a technical basis, they shouldn't have cracked the system until the end of 41 or even early 42. Luckily, the first break took place in January 1940. The reason being is we had some major help. It now turns out in the very late 20s, the Poles had come across a military Enigma and managed to copy all the wirings. But they were none the wiser about the physical applications. They eventually had the foresight to recruit 3 young, talented mathematicians, sent them back to university, and when they eventually re-graduated, were put on the project. In fact, within 4 months of starting that exercise, broke the then prevailing system, 3 out of 3 rotors and 6 cross pluggings. They even designed machinery to assist them in the regularity of cipher breaking, and for a period of 5 years, up to December 1938, they basically read every intercept they made. They were incredibly well informed, but nobody else in the world knew about it. When the Germans enhanced the performance of the Enigma, the Poles were stymied. They didn't have the resources to extend their researches. Luckily, their intelligence services were able to confirm that they were going to be invaded, so finally, in July 1939, they convened a meeting, inviting representatives from France and England to attend at a location outside Warsaw in the Karabaki Forest near the village of Piri, and there they handed over replicas of Enigma and copies of all the documentation they'd amassed over the intervening years. So it could be said that Dilwyn Knox and his team were very well provided for. Dilwyn Knox gathered together some very talented people, amongst whom we can include from the First World War people like Oliver Strachey, Dennis Babbage, no relation to Charles Babbage, by the way, Tony Kendrick, etc., an interwar recruit, Peter Twin, and then, of course, there's geometers from Cambridge, Gordon Welshman, Alan Turing, John Jeffries, etc., and we mustn't forget some very talented young ladies like Mavis Lever and Margaret Rock. It was, in fact, Alan Turing, on around the 20th of January, 1940, who made the first break in cottage number 3. The message in question, however, had been intercepted the previous December, so it wasn't even valid. It emanated from the Luftwaffe. Within a couple of months, they devised a system whereby they could read the German Air Force traffic on a daily basis. The German Army system, however, was broken subsequently. Different cipher department, different setup procedures. The German naval system, however, was not broken until May 1941. The German naval cipher department was the most proficient of all, and they, unlike everybody else using Enigma, weren't content with selecting 3 rotors from 5, they'd introduced a further 3 rotors, so 3 from 8, and then with the use of bigrams and trigrams in their setup procedures, highly complicated. Initial naval intelligence was provided, however, by a very talented Cambridge undergraduate aged 20 years old. His name was Harry Hinsley, based in Hut 4, and he was very good at what they call traffic analysis. And by studying increased volumes of traffic emanating from a particular area, he could come to certain logical conclusions, and then had the temerity to contact their lordships at the Admiralty, suggesting perhaps that major German warships were sailing from a particular port. As we had vessels in the area, they ought to pay attention. But the old sea salts couldn't take it. A civilian, landlocked in North Buckinghamshire, what could he tell them about affairs on the high seas? They ignored him. As a consequence, the Royal Navy suffered a series of losses, which eventually culminated in the major loss of the aircraft carrier HMS Glorious, a very well-recorded event. And after that, they paid one heck of a lot of attention to Harry Hinsley. He was able to give current information, because fortunately the Royal Navy managed to seize German naval monthly sheets from stranded submarines and also from deliberate operations where they went into the North Atlantic and captured German weatherships who subscribed to the same system. And when in possession of those sheets, for the period they were valid, they could give actually current information. But it was following a major seizure in 41 that they broke the system, and then the Admiralty was very well served. When within range, they could source and sink U-boats, but more importantly, they could divert convoys away from the wolf packs. So we were in receipt of the valuable cargoes. And then a total disaster. In February 42, the German Naval Cipher Department introduced a brand new Enigma machine, which effectively employed 4 active rotors. And such was the complexity of that machine, for some 10 months, our experts couldn't read the system. Luckily, towards the end of October 42, a U-boat was spotted in the Mediterranean and duly attacked. And after a lengthy engagement, finally blown to the surface, so badly damaged it was in the course of sinking. So the crew instantly abandoned ship. 2 of our guys, Swantlet U-boat, got aboard and went below and managed to retrieve some invaluable documents, which got passed up through the conning tower, and in turn got past the whaler when it eventually arrived. Sadly, immediately after that event, there was a sudden inrush of water. The U-boat 559 sank like a stone, and the two below perished. They were, in fact, the first officer and a naval seaman from HMS Petard. Well, the papers were rushed to land, to the nearest airfield, flown back to the UK, and subsequently here to Bletchley Park. And those documents, together with various other information, enabled the cipher breaks to re-establish themselves by the 15th of December 1942, and thereafter they read all the naval traffic on a consistent basis right through to the end of the war. And in fact, it was so effective that within 5 months, by the middle of May 1943, Admiral Dönitz withdrew the U-boats from the Atlantic due to the losses he was sustaining. So it goes to show the power of the intelligence when it was fully operational. Sadly, if you make a study of the Battle of the Atlantic, there were horrendous periods when nobody knew where the U-boats were. They were decimating our convoys. We were not in receipt of the valuable cargoes. And at one time, it got so bad that there was less than 3 months' worth of provisions in the warehouses to feed the populace, hence the huge increase in rationing. Well, after the initial breaks here, more and more staff were being recruited, so they had to move out of this area into the wooden huts. Now, I said earlier on that nobody lived on site. Well, you've always got to have exceptions to the rule. And these three cottages ended up being occupied by administrators. There was a family called Budge who lived in cottage number two, and they had a very young family, two boys, two girls. Of the two girls, they're both grown up. One lives in Luton and comes here normally on Sunday to act as a steward. Her sister, however, lives in Australia. And it's the sister in Australia who did that quilt that's hanging in the hallway. Childhood memories of Bletchley Park. Everything's depicted, and look at the Enigma machines, security gates, wireless aerials, Enigma machines, you name it, all sewn within it. Fascinating. The only bit of license she took is that she put the tennis courts in the middle of the stable yard. They were never here, they were always just outside. But one of the features on that quilt is pigeons at the top of the stable yard, because there was an active pigeon loft here during the war. Now, despite the expansion of the government code in cipher school, certain departments remained. And, of course, the Secret Service had agents in occupied Europe. Now, we've had confirmation from RAF pilots who flew out of Thamesmead in Lysanders that they took agents to Europe. Agents with radios, agents with pigeons, and also many fights dropping boxes of pigeons to agents in the field, never knowing where they came from or went to. That was the home loft. And the reason why pigeons were used so extensively is that the life expectancy of an agent in occupied Europe with a radio was only 6 weeks. You have to remember the Germans had detector vans crisscrossing the countryside, and once they got triangulation, it was capture, torture, and whatever. It's very difficult to shoot a pigeon with a 303, let alone a Schmeisser. The most important item here today, however, is at the end, a very simple monument dedicated to the Poles, for if they had not handed over those incredible secrets in July 1939, our experts here wouldn't have made such fast inroads and thus been in a position to give such comprehensive intelligence. So a major thank you to the Poles. If you'd like to come this way, please. I'm glad you appreciated that.